WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Columbus arrived in the, quote, New World 500 years ago, he wrote in his diary that the natives would make good and intelligent servants. After reading this journal entry, Michael Doris and his wife Louise Erdrich collaborated on the novel The Crown of Columbus. Now Doris has written a children's book in which he imagines the lives of two native children who were among the first to greet Columbus. Doris is a member of the Modoc tribe. He founded the Native American Studies program at Dartmouth College and has written about contemporary Native American life in his fiction and his essays. His novel, A Yellow Raft in Blue Water, is being made into a film by John Sayles. His bestseller, The Broken Cord, was about fetal alcohol syndrome, the set of problems brought on during fetal development when a pregnant woman drinks too much alcohol. Doris's adopted son had this syndrome. In 1991, as The Broken Cord was being made into a TV movie, Doris's son was killed in an accident. I spoke with Doris, and we talked first about his new children's book, Morning Girl, the story of an Indian family in 1492.
This is a part of a chapter narrated by a 10-year-old boy called Starboy, and he has been hiding out because he's mad at the world. His sister has been too nice to him. He has made a fool of himself in public, and he just doesn't know how to cope with all of this, and so he has been hiding out, ignoring the pleas of his family that he come back home and eat dinner. And this is the end of that part. When I had nothing else to think of, I simply let the air wash over me. I became the darkness. I listened to my breath as it ran in and out of my mouth like tides on the beach. I put my hands flat on the sand and felt the smoothness against my palms. I sniffed the air, got to know this great wide house, because I didn't know how long I would have to live in it. And without my ever noticing the change, I stopped being mad. I became myself. I must have slept, because I woke up and three things were different. The biting bugs had returned, the morning star had appeared in the eastern sky, and my mother had come to sit beside me. She was quiet, waiting, her body a dim shape settled so naturally into itself that until she spoke I couldn't be sure that she was not just my wish. "Tell me what you learned," she asked, her words low and like a dream. "At night," I answered in that same whispering tone, "at night you must be your own friend." My mother took a short breath, and I knew she understood.
That's very nice, and that's something certainly children of today would find no problem relating to. Explain to us how you tried to reconstruct what it was like for the first Taino child who ran into Columbus and his fellow explorers when they landed on the islands.
Well, I didn't want it to be about that. Columbus says in his journal when he first describes the Taino that he thinks they would make good and obedient servants. And he also says that one of the first people he met was one very young girl. And so I wanted to tell a story about that girl that ended at her first sight of him without any of the consequences, which we all understand so well, being described. I wanted it to be her story and the Taino story. So I tried to make it a kind of story that could be told through the perspective of children, which wouldn't be ethnographically incorrect, but also not pedantic. I mean, I think it has to be story first and instructional second.
This is your first children's book. Have you had trouble finding children's books with Native American characters to read to your children as they've been growing up?
I sure have, and I had trouble when I was a kid myself. So many of the books about Native Americans, I think, either portray Indians as kind of prescient. They're always having prophecy dreams of one kind or another that come true, and they're usually bad news. Or else they are kind of like earnest Boy Scouts. They are making clay pots, and they are asking questions about the origin of the universe. And they're basically not the kind of kids you would like to play with. They're much too adult-oriented and instructional kids. And so when I set out to try this, I wanted it to be first and foremost about children who parenthetically happen to be Native American and happen to live in the Bahamas in 1491 and happen to be the first ones to encounter Columbus. But that came second to character and story.
You've written about the imagery and popular culture of Indians, and you once wrote that people of proclaimed goodwill have the oddest ways of honoring American Indians. Flesh and blood Indians have been assigned the role of a popular culture metaphor. Today, their evocation connotes fuzzy images of nature, the past, plight, or summer camp. And I'll tell you, my summer camp's name was Camp Indian Head.
Hey, whose head was that? Yes.
So does this continue on? Do you think that like popular culture is becoming any more enlightened?
I hope so. I mean, I know that, for instance, there is a class action suit on a copyright basis against the Washington Redskins that's about to come about, with the idea that if you appropriate the image of another group of people and you commercialize it in a way, it absolutely obscures the reality of that group of people. It sort of sticks them at a certain point in time, and that's frustrating, and it's tacky, basically. I went to Zimbabwe this summer writing about the drought that's been going on for 7 years there and about the refugee camps of Mozambicans that are throughout the eastern part of Zimbabwe. And I come back and try and talk about that to people, and I note the same impressions of Africa with you. If you could change the name of Africa to 19th century Indians, and they would be very, very similar. I think we haven't progressed all that much.
Mm-hmm. What's the similarity that you see?
Well, they are cast in stone. They are predictable. They speak a certain way. They look a certain way. They have certain attitudes that everybody believes they know and they can recognize, when in fact, when you get there, it's a very rich and amazing place.
You are in Zimbabwe because you're on the board now of Save the Children. And, I'm wondering, as someone who's Native American, you've probably experienced what it's like when someone who's not of the culture, a white person, comes with an attitude of trying to help and isn't necessarily all that informed about what kind of help would be best. Mm-hmm. Were you self-conscious about being the outsider when you went to Zimbabwe to, analyze what was happening with the drought?
I was very self-conscious, and I didn't do a lot of the things that I remember people doing in communities where I had lived. For instance, I didn't go and see sick people, and I didn't go and find the obvious story of somebody who looked like they were in great distress. Rather, I listened to people who seemed very credible and never presumed to know more than an outsider knows. Basically, what I tried to do is collect testimonials from people who were there in the middle of things, and I could act as I told them, their microphone back through the New York Times and the LA Times and the Washington Post to people of goodwill who were really, truly, genuinely interested.
What do you find offensive about the idea of writing about a very sick person or, singling out one tragedy?
Well, of course, everybody likes a story. A story makes things come to life much more than statistics do. But I know if I were sick or a member of my family were sick and an outsider who was passing through in a four-wheel drive vehicle came for 10 minutes and wanted the highlights of my distress, I would find it very offensive. It might be effective, but it doesn't make it moral.
What's the closest you came to that when you were living on a reservation and outsiders would come in?
Well, actually, one of the funny things, we used to be the beneficiary of people in Cleveland who would donate money and clothing. And this would be distributed. And one of the perks that they got for donating money and clothing is that they got to name somebody. And so we would get named.
Oh, gee.
And I must say, I once had the name Aloysius, which
oh, no.
Which I'm sure was the name of a parish that someone of very good will. And the other thing is people used to donate, I've never seen them since, undershirts with buttons on the shoulders. Whenever I think of that whole process, I think of buttons on the shoulders.
So did you grow up both liking and also both appreciating but really resenting the people from outside who were trying to help?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, when you live within the context of an overall situation, you don't analyze it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of the life that goes on. I by no means mean to disparage or discourage people who are generous. I would ask them to send both a left and a right shoe. You know, I mean, that is nice. Not one shoe doesn't do a lot of good. But I just wrote a long essay that will be in the next Mother Jones magazine about trying to explain to people in Zimbabwe the issue of how deluged we Americans are on a daily basis with good causes through the mail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, each one carefully packaged by a professional marketer, and each one quite worthy. And you get to the point where you think that nothing you can do can make a difference, and if you've given $10 last year and it didn't solve the problem, well, goodbye to that charity. When in fact, I think there are many things in this world that require an ongoing commitment without the expectation that it's going to succeed.
My guest is writer Michael Doris. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Doris is my guest, and he's written his first book for children, and it's called Morning Girl. Last month was the first anniversary of the death of your son, Abel, who you wrote about in your book, The Broken Cord, which is about fetal alcohol syndrome. And I suspect a lot of our listeners saw a kind of made-for-TV movie adaptation of that story. Did you have some kind of ritual for marking the anniversary of the death? Did you feel the need and the usefulness for something like that?
We planted a tree in a place that he loved, and we, with a very small group of people, talked about our complicated memories of him. And it isn't a kind of ritual that you can find in a book or anything else, but it was healing. He was a very vivid person. And I think that is why the book was written, because he demanded attention. He demanded indignation, because even with all of his exasperating qualities, of which there were many, and I don't want to gloss over those, there was within Abel a gentleness and a kindness and a patience that will instruct many of us forever. And I think it is the frustration that those qualities couldn't be available to the world in the way that they should have been that convinced Louise and me to write about our experience and encourage Abel to write the last chapter, which he did, and make a contribution by example that he couldn't make through action. And you know, I think in the final analysis, we're enormously proud of him.
You know, you use the expression complicated memories, your complicated memories of your son. I think many people feel that to honor the dead, you should kind of forget the things they did that caused you pain and only remember the good things. And it sounds to me like what you want to do is remember your son in his full complexity and as honestly as possible.
Well, that's true. And when I did field work in Alaska about 20 years ago, I remember very well the traditional funerals of the Athabascan Dena'ina people that I lived with and whose language I learned. And the commemoration service, which generally took place a year after the death, was three parts. On the first day, you grieved very dramatically and cried and wept. The second day, you told brave stories about what the person had done, admirable things. And the third day, when everybody was really exhausted and worn out with the process, everybody told the funniest story that they ever remembered about the deceased person. And there was a relief in the laughter that came. And after that, people ate and slept. And it put a kind of closure to the experience in remembering that complexity.
What have you been able to find out about the accident that killed him?
There aren't witnesses. Since he was mentally disabled, the presumption was that it was in part his fault. I don't believe it. I devoted 2 years of my life and more to teaching Abel to cross the street. And we were so meticulous about that, that he would only cross after the light had been red when it turned green. And he never made a mistake about that. He was crossing a street he had crossed 100 times from work. And I think it was not his fault. And, you know, initially there was a kind of impulse to pursue that. But finally, one has to accept and go on.
So it was a hit-and-run accident?
It wasn't run. It was a hit-and-run-and-stop accident. But a person who told a different version than I have just recounted.
I see. And you've decided not to take legal action?
There's no witness. There is my knowledge and my testimony that Abel was an expert at crossing the street. But I don't think I'm going to be heard on that.
Right. You found out about your son's accident right after you landed in Los Angeles to consult for the made-for-TV movie about his life. Just one of those really horrible ironies. When something like that happens in your life, you just don't know. You're supposed to interpret that in some way? I mean, what do you do with that?
Oh, it was unbelievable, because I landed and heard about this, and I wasn't able to get a plane back. He was in intensive care for several weeks, so it wasn't an immediate thing, but I wasn't able to get a plane back for hours, and so there was this thing that I had to go to, in which Jimmy Smits, who played me in the movie and who was a lovely man and a wonderful actor, and I think did a fine job with the film. Its goodness was in great part due to the commitment of people like him and Ken Olin, who was the director. And so I sort of went into this meeting with the two of them, and you know, it's sort of Victor Cifuentes and Michael Stedman, you know. And it just added a layer of surreality to the whole experience. They both were very kind and considerate and basically just kind of waited with me. And then I went back, and they have continued to be kind, and I think they made a film which I think I heard somewhere that 30 million people saw. And I hope through that experience it kind of filters into the folklore of our society that drinking during pregnancy is a risk not worth taking. That was the point of writing the book. That was the point of having it made into a film and sacrificing the amount of privacy that we sacrificed.
I want to shift the subject back again to your new children's book, Morning Girl, which, as we discussed before, is about the first Native Americans who saw Columbus when he landed. What does Columbus Day mean to you now? It's recently become a subject of great controversy.
It is, but let me transition back with you from where we are, because I don't think they're unrelated, what we've just been talking about with this book, because one of the things that a writer can do is imagine. And in that I've had children who were deprived of their fullness by fetal alcohol syndrome, in effect, when I set out to write children characters and to write in their voice, I wanted to have fully invested kids. And I'm sure that my own children were in my mind as to who they might have been, could have been, and should have been. And so I have a special affection for Starboy and Morning Girl. And I don't really want to confuse them with Columbus. This is their story. And the thing about the coincidence of Columbus bumping into these people just at the time that these two kids were about to reach maturity is that they didn't have the chance to do it. They were, through no desire of Columbus's, I don't think, victims of European diseases and didn't survive, the people, the Taino people, for more than a generation or so, except those who were brought back as slaves by Columbus in subsequent voyages. They deserve a voice that is not mixed with the fact that they were the first, they were the welcome wagon. I know it sounds kind of strange to say that when the book is published around the time of the quincentennial, but I think maybe especially because the book is published around the time of the quincentennial. I go into bookstores, children's bookstores now, and there are shelves full of I Was a Cabin Boy with Christopher Columbus and the voyages of 1492 and the heroics of Columbus and all of this kind of stuff. And I think, where are the Taino in all of this? Where are these people who for at least 2,000 years had a complex, civilized, and fulfilling life for themselves? And I think one of the greatest injustices is that they vanish in fiction even as they vanished in fact. And I hope that people who read this will remember them, even though I'm sure I made a million mistakes, and it's all made up, and it's totally presumptuous on the part of some 20th century mixed-blood person to try and imagine what life might have been like in that community, except that I did imagine they had a sense of humor, and I did imagine that they were complicated, and I did imagine that they had imaginative lives. And you don't find enough Native American characters with those qualities.
Well, Michael Doris, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Doris's new children's book, set in 1492, is called Morning Girl. It's published by Hyperion. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.